This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Earlier this month, we met a pair of attorneys on a mission. They're working to increase awareness about the consequences of committing crimes. We're not just talking jail time here. They focus on lesser-known punishments that penalize people even after they've paid their debt to society. Public housing programs, private employers, schools, and other institutions often have policies that place the act that act as barriers to people with criminal records. The lawyers have created the Collateral Consequences Assessment Tool. It's a database designed to help people understand what they're really up against once they've been convicted of a crime. The creators are Daryl Atkinson. One of them is Daryl. He's a staff attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, and we welcome him back to the program. Daryl, welcome back. Good to be here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back, Frank.
Also joining us is someone who's experienced collateral consequences firsthand. Benjamin Hashim is with me today in the studio, and I'd like to welcome you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, Daryl, so we know. It's no secret. Employers have that box. They ask if you've ever been convicted. You check it. So we know that just in employment, it's a factor. What are some of the more surprising ways that criminal convictions can have an impact on somebody beyond their sentence or whatever they've done to pay their debt?
So you mentioned employment as being one of the big ones. Public housing, public benefits, your welfare benefits can be stopped. Access to higher education, and Mr. Hashim will tell you a little bit about that in his story. As far as getting admitted to schools, you could potentially be denied your federal financial student aid. You can lose scholarships or grants because of a criminal conviction. So those are just a few.
And all of that is legal?
No, it's perfectly legal.
So tell us, because you've had firsthand experience with this as well. You have a criminal record. You talked briefly about it, but tell us more. Give us the details.
Well, in 1996, I was convicted of a nonviolent drug crime. I spent 40 months in prison in the Alabama Department of Corrections. I consider myself a casualty of America's ill-conceived and highly racialized war on drugs. At that time, the state of Alabama wasn't nearly as progressive as North Carolina. They didn't offer any post-secondary education opportunities. I couldn't take any correspondence courses. So I basically just languished in prison. And I came in with a high school diploma. I left with a high school diploma. The only thing that separated me from 1,000 other brilliant men who I met behind the wall is that I returned to a viable support system, a loving family who could offer me food, clothing, and shelter, so I didn't have those immediate needs pressing upon me. Not everyone is going to return to that kind of support system, so it's important for us in civil society to create secondary support systems so more people can be successful. We do that with the laws and policies and programs that we have for people who've been justice involved.
So in your case, as you say, 40 months for a nonviolent, this was a possession charge?
It was a trafficking charge. And the way that it works in Alabama, if you have a certain threshold amount of a certain drug you're trafficking, whether you're actually moving on the roads or flying in the air or not, you know, people have a misconception of what a drug trafficker is. They think of Pablo Escobar or some kind of cartel member. But in North Carolina and in Alabama and many other states, if you have a certain threshold amount of a substance, that can kick you into that category where you're going to be imposed a mandatory minimum sentence, irrespective of your past background. The judge will have no discretion.
So you spend more than 3 years in prison, it's over, and now you come out. And what were some of the things that you faced? As you said, at least you had a support, so you didn't have to get a job right away, because you can imagine getting out of jail with a high school diploma, a prison, a felony record, and now you have no way to support yourself and nobody's going to hire you.
Exactly.
What are the options?
So some of the immediate obstacles that I face, Alabama, one of the collateral consequences of being convicted of a drug offense there was that your driver's license was automatically suspended, even if you weren't driving when you committed your offense. So I had to get my driver's license back. I was denied access to educational institutions. I think I put in 3 different applications to various institutions in the area where I relocated to Columbia, South Carolina. And I got several rejection letters because of my criminal background, even though I graduated from a junior college with honors.
Well, let me ask you, did they say that explicitly? How did you know that it was because of your criminal background?
Well, it was more winks and nods, if you will. I had an academic advisor at the community college that I went to who was really advocating on my behalf, and he called them up and asked them what was the problem, because I had graduated the junior college with a 4.0 grade point average, and they basically said that we didn't want to risk allowing someone with a criminal history on our campus.
So you eventually get the license, but you're having a hard time going to school. What are some of the other things that you ran into?
Well, obviously employment barriers. Right. You know, you put in application after application, and no matter how qualified you are for a job, you always feel this gnawing feeling of anxiety in your stomach is, you know, are they going to ask me about my background? Is my background going to come up? Is it going to be an automatic bar? And more than having to explain the situation, because I think people like Benjamin and myself are more than equipped to talk about our past and talk about things that we've done since that time to try to rehabilitate ourselves, if you will. We're more than adept to be able to explain that, but just even whether we're going to get the opportunity to explain it. And having to, you know, go time and time again and go through that process is trying. And it can really test your fortitude on how committed you are to change.
Benjamin, you have had some of the similar experiences with employers and graduate school. What's your situation?
Well, in the past I have applied to employers, and I was explicitly told that my criminal background was the reason why I was unemployable.
And what's on your record? What are your convictions?
I have a misdemeanor concealed weapons charge and a misdemeanor controlled substance charge.
So those are on the record, and you have to report that, and you
yes.
do. And employers say, we're not going to hire you.
Well, it's a catch-22. You're trying to be honest when you check that box on that application, to let them know you do have that in your character. And either way it goes, they use it against you. If you don't check the box and they find out later, they use it against you then. So me personally, I try to be upfront about it. And hopefully I run across people that will appreciate that.
So then you tried to get into graduate school.
Yes, I did. A local university, after much prying and trying to get to the bottom, I was given a form letter that stated that I didn't have the requirements. And I replied back that I didn't understand what requirements I didn't meet because according to their website and the university, that I did meet the requirements that were required for the program. And after several permutations of getting to the bottom of it, I finally received a statement from an official stating that basically that my criminal record would inhibit me from employment in the field. Them not knowing or not paying attention to my other application materials that I was already employed in the field.
And then what is that field?
I'm in the human services field.
So, and what kind of work do you do?
I work for a local nonprofit juvenile intervention program.
Right, so you've got this job. You're trying to improve your credentials so that you can get a better job. You want to go to grad school. And we should point out, we're not naming the school because you're now involved in a lawsuit. So we're going to keep that out of this conversation. There's a lawsuit involved at the moment, and you've sued them. And but they're saying to you, well, we aren't going to admit you because we don't think you'll ever get a job, and therefore we just really don't want to take you in our program to train you for this job that
exactly.
we don't think you're ever going to get.
Exactly.
But you're already working in the field.
I'm already working in the field. I'm just seeking to enhance my position within the field with higher education.
So what do you do in this case? Now, in this case, you took them to court. You're working, as you say, you do have a job.
Yes, sir.
And you're working with young people. So who's ever hired you there has decided that you're worth the risk, that whatever the risk is, it's not too great.
Right.
How does that work? How were you able to get – because it seems to me they might have been concerned. What was that conversation like with them? Was it a long and difficult conversation?
No, it wasn't at all, because they took my character into account. And that's another thing. During the application process, there's supposed to be an interview, and I wasn't even allowed to get to that level so that they could meet me and see what type of person I was. And maybe they could come to a different conclusion about my character than they did just from those objective data that was on the application.
Daryl, I have heard that some of the problem is that there is no subjective, there's no process, particularly when it comes to large corporations, that their attorneys have just decided it's too great a risk. The answer is no, it's a blanket no. We're not going to make any judgments because that leaves us vulnerable to a lawsuit should something happen.
And that's true, Frank. One of the things that I want to point out in Benjamin's story is the illogic, if you will, of the response that he received, that higher education access and you getting this degree, we're worried that it won't result in you being employable in the field. I can personally attest that higher education, attaining higher degrees of education, actually made me more employable. It made employers more willing to look past something that I had done over 15 years ago. So the illogic of that rationale just speaks volumes for me. With regards to, I want to highlight a success in the area where we've gotten at least public employers to think a little bit differently about the hiring process. At the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, we were successful in partnership with the Durham Southside community in persuading both the city of Durham and the county of Durham to remove that question about criminal record history off the initial application. It doesn't mean that background checks aren't done. It just delays them until later on in the process, after someone has had an opportunity to have an interview and they've been selected as a finalist. So once they've been selected as a finalist and given a conditional offer of employment, the background check is then done. That person then has the opportunity to check the accuracy of the record, to submit evidence of rehabilitation, and then the hiring authority has to establish a nexus or a direct relationship between their past criminal conduct and the prospective job. We call this initiative Ban the Box, and Ban the Box movements have been going on across the country. Over 30 cities have administratively or through local ordinances banned the box, and 5 states have done it as well as far as all state employment.
Certainly sounds like a rational process. In other words, I'm allowed to consider the likelihood everything in your record and the likelihood that your record somehow bears on your job. But what about this liability question? And I ask it because I wonder if there's a need for legislation at some point to provide a kind of a special case or some protection against liability that has attorneys working for these corporations so worried about what might happen to them.
No, and that's a good point. But we already have that legislation in our recent Certificate of Relief legislation, which the Certificate of Relief bill relieves someone of the collateral consequences associated with their conviction. It basically transforms an automatic collateral consequence, something that would be automatically imposed, to a discretionary collateral consequence. And a key provision of that is that it offers immunity to lawsuits for negligent hiring or negligent leaseholding or admitting someone to a university. What we have to work on now is expanding who's eligible for a certificate, because right now it only applies to a certain narrow class of individuals.
Benjamin, what does this do to you? What would a graduate degree do for you? I mean, how would it change what you're doing now and, you know, your own situation?
Well, being a single parent, it would allow me to have a better quality of life and a lot more mobility and opportunity. And I could go further with a upper level degree.
You can imagine, Daryl, we know the correlation between education and contact with the criminal justice system. The less education there is, the more likelihood. And it really seems, as you said, like you're building in a structure. If you're not going to allow anybody, or you're going to put barriers in their way for people who have had any contact with the criminal justice system, you're just insisting that they remain in that system.
No, you're exactly right. And look, we are certainly sensitive and conscious that there are certain concerns. For example, if someone has a past history of substance abuse, you might be legitimately concerned with them getting into your pharmacy program, because there may be legitimate concerns about them being a pharmacist later on in life and being able to get employed in that field. That's why it's so important to establish and think case by case about what is the direct relationship that we are worried about between their past and the prospective job or the prospective vocation that they might go into.
Now, Benjamin, have you decided to apply to other grad schools?
Well, I'm really at a quandary with that situation, because I don't want to keep going through this process if this is going to be held against me every time. It costs money to apply to these schools, money that I don't have to dispense in that vein of expenditure, you know. So I'm really want to address this issue because it's bigger than me. I think it's a wholesale disenfranchisement of Americans, period, because it's bigger than a racial issue because it applies universally. So I think it needs to be addressed on a higher level.
How widespread is it? Now, this is a private university in your case. So how Daryl, I mean, does it sound to you like they can win this lawsuit? Or can universities do whatever they want and establish whatever policies they want with regard to taking students in?
Well, I will say this. We are very much in the early stages of the advocacy on Benjamin's case. Public universities certainly have some educational guidelines that they have to adhere to based on federal law. Private universities, that's another matter, and we're investigating whether they can and should, if you will, be able to impose automatic barriers on people with criminal record history. We hope that that litigation doesn't have to be the ultimate avenue that we use for change. And as Benjamin said, this is much bigger than him. We have 1.6 million North Carolinians in this state with a criminal record. That translates to 1 in 6 adults over the age of 16. I stress over the age of 16 because we charge 16 and 17-year-olds as adults in this state. So this is a community problem. This is a statewide problem, and we need to think about how we want to provide avenues of access for people who've made past mistakes. So as Benjamin pointed out, this is much bigger than just his individual case, and he must be commended in going forward and not just looking at his individual resolution that may end up in success for him, but ultimately paving the way for the next group of folks who come behind him so they can have access as well.
And tell us again about your database and what it does and how it can help people who've been through the criminal justice system.
So the database is the Collateral Consequence Assessment Tool. I co-manage that project with Whitney Fairbanks at the UNC School of Government. And you can go and just put in a Google search for Collateral Consequence Assessment Tool, or CCAT. And you subscribe. And once you subscribe, you'll have access to search for the collateral consequences of arrests, indictments, and convictions in the state of North Carolina. So you can search two ways. You can search by characteristics of crime. Did I commit a felony? Did I commit a misdemeanor? Was it a crime of substance abuse? Was it a crime of fraud or moral turpitude? And it will generate a list like Google. And you can filter using that list to get to the consequence that you are specifically worried about. Am I worried about my ability to adopt? Am I worried about my ability to live in public housing? Am I worried about occupational or employment licenses? So that's one way of searching. You can also search from the consequence side. Let's say if I know specifically that I'm currently an electrical contractor and I'm worried about how this DUI offense could potentially affect me maintaining my electrical contractor's license. You can go straight and search under electrical contractors and see what crimes trigger any prohibitions on your licensure.
And I've only got about 20 seconds left, but is this something that can just tell me the bad news, or does knowing this in some way help mitigate these consequences?
Knowing it certainly can help you tailor a better reentry plan. So, for example, if I'm currently in the Department of Corrections or I've been justice involved and I'm thinking about what educational or vocational track that I want to take, I could use the database to avoid areas where I'm going to face an absolute bar, or I'm going to have a very high threshold of proof to show that I'm worthy to receive this given license or certificate. So it totally can help someone tailor a better reentry plan.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Great talking with you. Daryl Atkinson, staff attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, co-creator of the Collateral Consequences Assessment Pool. Thank you, Daryl, for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Benjamin Hashim, who has been on the program to increase our awareness and talk about his lawsuit and expectations and hopes of getting into grad school. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the program next, how informed citizen used legal resources to save a mountain in western North Carolina. Law and Order Week continues. Stay with us on the State of Things.